Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at www.westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of June 2024, and this is episode 335. On today's podcast, we are honoured to have former GP and author David Keeble Elliott. David talks about an account he wrote of his grandfather on the Western Front serving in the Royal Field Artillery. Colin Hutchinson started out as a lowly sub-lieutenant commanding one gun and then rose to command a brigade of 24 guns at the end of the war. David reflects on the observations and the notes that his grandfather made and looks at how the Royal Field Artillery evolved throughout the war. David spoke to me from his home in the south of England. David, welcome to the podcast. Let's begin by exploring the central figure of this book, Second Lieutenant Colin Hutchinson. Can you provide some insights into his personal journey from enlisting in the army as a young man to his role with the Royal Field Artillery during the First World War?
Yes, well, thank you. First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I think you're quite right to start with Colin's, my grandfather's character. This is a book of letters from him to his mother, and they need to be interpreted within the background of his upbringing and the sort of man that he was. Obviously, what he has to say may or may not be important as far as the tactical background of the war is concerned. But first of all, we have to work out whether he's a reliable witness or not. So what can I tell you about my grandfather? First of all, he was born in 1893 in Japan. His father was a businessman out there, and the whole family returned to England in about 1907. And the reason why they returned was because his youngest brother, who was 2 years younger than him, was then going to school in England, as Colin had 2 years before, and his older brother had before that. He went to school at Murchison Castle in Edinburgh, which was a good staunch public school and had a strong officer training corps. And at the officer training corps, he earned Certificate A, which is the first step in getting a post as an officer in the British Army. He was bright in the sense that he understood physics and maths quite well, and he applied for the Woolwich Military Academy, which trains engineers and artillery officers for the army, and he joined them in 1911. He graduated from Woolwich at the beginning of 1913, was immediately accepted into the Royal Artillery, and he went to Borden on Salisbury Plain, attached to the 3rd Division for the whole of 1914. He was a young man, obviously. He wasn't 20, he was only 20 when he went there. And he was a boy that enjoyed life. He had a motorbike, which he used to visit home. He had girlfriends, one of whom his younger brother hinted was rather more important than the rest. But in letters from his mother, we don't discover much about that side of things. He was very much a sportsman. He played golf and he played tennis almost county standard. He went skiing in France. In fact, he visited France quite a lot, and he spoke fluent French as a consequence, which of course was very helpful for him when he went to war in 1914. But his most important sport was rugby, and he was extremely good. When he got down to England, he played for the army, which was quite prestigious, and he got introduced to the King, who was watching the 1914 game, and he played regularly for the London Scottish. He had a chance of being a Scottish international. He was certainly well known in this country. All the matches were reported, and he was therefore something of a minor celebrity in 1914. I just want to enlarge, I think, a bit on the sporting side of things, because the teamwork that he learnt as a fly half in rugby, and the whole ethos of sport was very important to him throughout his life. I just want to skip to April 1917, when the brigade he was with, it was pretty low ebb. This was in the spring of 1917. The colonel, to try and cheer things up, challenged the South Wales borderers to a rugby match with the brigade. Colin, who had been wounded in 1916, was slightly nervous when he was told going to be captain, but he had very little choice. And they went to the match. There were 1,500 spectators at the match, and the South Wales Borderers bought their own regimental band. So it was a big affair. And I just want to quote from what he said. "They had a very burly lot of forwards, and we were outplayed in the scrums. We had some very good players. One subaltern was a reserve for Ireland, and another had played for Natal in South Africa, and a very fine player he was." They actually won the match, and the impact from his letters on the brigade was quite extraordinary. From being quite depressed, suddenly the whole brigade seemed to be buzzing. So sport was important right through the war. I'm going to take him now to war. War obviously was declared in August 1914, and as a regular, he was immediately mobilised, and he went off on the Mons campaign. He fought right the way through. We'll probably come back to this a little bit, but he fought through the whole of the Mons campaign, so all four battles of it, Mons, Lakato, the Marne and the Aisne, and then Ypres, all five battles of it. And he also had a fairly vigorous engagement in a skirmish at Salim before the Battle of Lakato, at which his commanding officer, his battery commander, was killed. So he had a fairly lively time of it. Initially, he was absolutely terrified. There's no other word for it. At Mons, watching all the shells bursting and the smoke and the noise and everything, was a terrifying experience for a young man who'd never known anything like it. But he settled down and knuckled in and became much more professional. And by the Marne, which was, let's face it, only 3 or 4 weeks later, he was actually entrusted with the command of a single gun. To be fair, it was a pretty disastrous expedition. He was sent out to relieve some troops that were pinned down by 3 or 4 machine guns, and he took his gun too close. He took his gun out into the open, and the machine guns started firing at him, and they all cowered behind the cover. And the brigade diary is quite honest. It said sent one gun to help, couldn't do much. He got rescued by a troop of the Royal Horse Artillery who dealt with the machine guns, and all was well. He then went on to the Aisne. Again, at the Aisne, he was entrusted as the observation officer for his battery right out on an exposed spot on high hills above the River Aisne. And while he was there, General Smith Dorrien came with his staff to observe from that point, because it had a particularly good view of the whole length of the line. And Colin told Smith Dorrien that he couldn't allow all his staff in. It was too small and the enemy would probably see it. So he had Smith Dorrien on his own in the observation post. Now, Smith Dorrien wasn't a man who suffered fools gladly, but he spent 20 minutes with Colin and exchanged genial anecdotes with him. And Colin was always very, very complimentary about him afterwards. But he was clearly very comfortable in his role. Colin was very comfortable in his role as a junior officer. He got wounded at First Ypres. We don't know very much about what happened at First Ypres, but he got wounded and he was then sent home. And probably the most important thing from my point of view was that when he got home, his mother gave him an enormous rocket and told him that his letters were absolutely useless. She wanted more information. She didn't want any brief platitudes. She wanted to know exactly what she was doing, what he was doing. And furthermore, that message got through to to Colin's younger brother when he went to war 6 months later, and to his mother's brother, who also went to war in 1916. And all three of them from the moment they arrived on the line, sent their letters back informing mother of exactly what was happening. So I inherited a collection of about 1,500 letters, and they are a quite extraordinary archive. I'm going to move on to 1915. I think of this as his year of disillusionment. He was posted to the Canadian Division, which raised a few eyebrows because the regulars didn't really like associating with the colonials. But he fell in love with the Canadians very quickly. And he was present at the on the first day of Second Ypres, which again we'll come on to, and won his first military cross there. He then transferred with the Canadians almost immediately into the carnage and horror that was Festubert and Givenchy, serving in those first two offensive battles of 1915. And he lapsed fairly quickly into exhaustion. It was obviously a very depressing time, mid-1915, to be out on the front. Everybody was bereaved, but everybody. All his friends had lost friends, or even a lot of his school friends had been killed. All his girlfriends had lost friends or brothers. He lost his own brother, that I briefly mentioned, Donald, in August 1915. And he really got quite isolated. He describes during that time coming back to his battery when a barrage started, and he just sat down in a field, put his hand over his head, and waited for a shell to land on his head. So he was really at a very low edge. He was saved really by his colonel, by his major in the battery, who'd been promoted to a colonel by that stage. This was the Major Lambard who commanded him at Second Ypres, who promoted him to his adjutant so that he wasn't permanently on the front line and he could get back and forward and have a few nights' sleep without disturbance. By 1916, he was very much more professional. He was headhunted to become a battery commander in the 7th Division, which was an extraordinary, really, when he was still a lieutenant. They made him an honorary captain. A battery, just to explain, a battery was normally commanded by a major, but a lot of, due to the number of casualties, a lot of captains were coming in to command batteries, and he was promoted to acting captain in order to do so. And he served thoroughly professionally in the 7th Division. He found it difficult because in the Canadian Division, everybody called a spade. That's a wrong term to use. I shouldn't use that. But everybody was entirely honest about what was happening. But in the regular divisions, one really had to keep one's mouth zipped and not make any criticisms of anybody. It was probably quite good for him. And he served with distinction through the Somme. We'll come back to that probably, and then was wounded at Fleurs, which was the first battle in which the tanks were involved. Just to explain what happened at Fleurs, he was a forward observation officer, so he was right up with the infantry who were advancing, and he and another officer settled themselves with their assistants, settled themselves in a shell hole in order to observe from the top of a ridge. And a German battery spotted them and fired at them, killing his fellow officer instantly. And Colin was incredibly lucky to survive. He got a bit of shrapnel straight through his cheek and bled very heavily. He managed to make his own way back in the convoy from this back to the base, but he was obviously sent home very quickly, and it took him quite a few months to recover. 1917, fiendishly cold winter, and he went out pretty well January the 1st, 1917, to join an army brigade. I'll come on to the significance of that later. An army brigade was quite different in organisation from a field artillery brigade with a division. And he was initially with Plumer's 2nd Army, and army brigades were posted to help the regular divisions. So at Messines Ridge, which Plumo was had been preparing for an assault there for many months. His artillery brigade was moved from division to division, really to bring up the standard of the new divisions, whose artillery left quite a lot to be desired. Colin had a lot of trust in Plumer, and Plumer did give their artillery brigade independence for the actual battle, and they charged into battle in, as far as I can see, almost one of the last charges of the Royal Field Artillery, with their guns bouncing behind them and their horses throwing themselves into a position and then firing in support of the infantry in front of him. Almost immediately, Seine Ridge was underway. They were moved to Gough's 5th Army, and that was a completely different scene. He found the whole ethos of the 5th Army extremely difficult to tolerate, and became very disillusioned about the way the battle was being fought, and had considerable anger at the way that men were being treated and the army was being treated at Passchendaele. Gough was of course sacked after a month at Passchendaele due to poor progress, which was just as well, I think. My impression from his letters is that the army were close to revolt. But Plumer took command of Passchendaele. There was a 6-week break, and Plumer completely altered the arrangements for the artillery at Passchendaele, and Colin was a lot happier thereafter. But there's no doubt he was traumatised by what is re-traumatised, really. It's very clear in my mind, I think, that he had certainly moderate, if not severe, traumatic stress through the latter half of 1915 and through the latter half of 1917 and into 1918. But he did manage to keep going. Just 1918 was his sort of year of achievement, though he put his head down and refused to cooperate with the staff in any way. He was an extremely effective senior battery commander within his brigade. They covered themselves in glory in the German spring offensive in an assault at Meteren, where he won an MC. And then he again at 5th Ypres, when his colonel was wounded, he commanded the brigade himself at the Battle of Courtrai in October 1918, which was part of the last 100 days battles, where he won a DSO. At the end of the war, he was regularly being accused of being accused of 40 years of age. He was in fact 25, so it wasn't just his mental state that was aged; his whole persona was aged. There's one point I'd just like to make at this stage, that in the letters there are very, very few. He refers to very, very few referrals to senior generals. Haig is not mentioned once in the entire correspondence, and I find it quite extraordinary, and nor in fact in his brothers or uncles. I do find it extraordinary that none of the three in over 1,000 letters ever mentioned their senior commanding officer. Colin does mention Smith Dorrien, I've already mentioned him. He does mention French in 1914. He mentions Plumer from time to time throughout the war, but he doesn't mention any of the other generals, and he certainly doesn't mention Gough, who he obviously thoroughly disapproved of. I think we have to take that back to Edwardian conventions. If you can't say something nice about somebody, then don't say anything at all. And that's how I read it. But other people may read it differently.
No, okay. I'm just thinking my own grandfather's unit and various units in the 56th Division, which was my grandfather's formation, were on the verge of mutiny after 3rd Ypres. Even nice units like the London Rifle Brigade. But well, let's go to question two. Sorry, I interjected there. Now, the book mentions that Colin played a number of roles within the artillery, ranging from commanding a single gun, to which you've already alluded, and also overseeing a brigade of 24 guns. Could you give some of the key moments or experiences from Colin's life that particularly stand out and highlight his growth and adaptation within the Royal Field Artillery?
Yes, sure. The story told in Corin's letters is quite extraordinary in that he was so close up in the action on the first day of so many battles. And I think a formative one was Second Ypres, to which I've already mentioned. He joined the Canadians with a small, very small howitzer brigade. It was two batteries of four guns. Because the Canadians only had field artillery, they didn't have any howitzers. So there were four Canadian field artillery brigades, batteries, but there was three you know, brigades, Canadian artillery, three artillery brigades, I believe, but they didn't have an howitzer brigade, and their British contingent made it up. It was very much made up of regulars who'd been wounded in 1914, I think. I don't know where their commander, I still haven't got very much information about him, a Major Lambard, who's actually key to this book. He was Colin's superior officer at Second Ypres, which I'm going to describe, but he remained a senior officer to Colin throughout the war. They arranged things so that they could stay together, basically. And I think one of the reasons they did was because they got so close at Second Ypres. The Canadians were in the line on the 21st of April, and they moved on the 21st of April to take over a French division at Ypres. Pretty well the day they arrived, they realised that the position that they'd been assigned to had been spotted by the Germans. They were put into French gun emplacements, and they realised immediately they got into the French gun emplacements that they needed to move. They were regulars, so they really didn't ask permission. They simply upsticked overnight and moved both batteries back 200 yards into slightly better positions. They were howitzers, so obviously howitzers fire up and over, whereas field guns fire straight. So it was quite easy with howitzers to move back behind a bit of cover so that you weren't visible from the enemy and fire very effectively from there. The next day, the evening of the 21st, the Germans opened fire as they'd expected, and they completely destroyed the brigade headquarters, including all the communications and all their papers, and they destroyed the empty gun emplacements that the French had left, but both batteries were spared. The colonel was at the brigade headquarters at the time, and really he drops out of the picture straight away. He had a nervous breakdown, and we don't really hear anything more of him. So the two battery commanders were basically independent at this stage. The chlorine then swept over the Canadians and over the French to their left, mainly to the French to their left. So the French broke, and there was a gap of about a mile and a half to the left of the Canadians, through which the Germans could stream. They did so very unenthusiastically, unsurprisingly, because of the chlorine. They really didn't want to gas themselves. So it took a bit of time for the assault to develop, and took time as well for it to develop on the Canadian front line, which hadn't buckled. They fired, Collins' battery fired initially in support of the Canadians, but with the whole of their left flank open and all with rifle bullets already arriving from their left flank, they thought it wise to withdraw and did so. It's unclear whether they did it under orders. They probably didn't have specific orders since communications had been broken, but I think they met up with a Canadian field artillery battery who asked them to follow them and retire in the same direction. The Canadian commander of artillery was a very competent officer, and he asked all his batteries to form between Ypres and the Canadian front line in order to support the Canadians as much as he could. However, Major Lambard with 458 clearly met up at some stage on the retreat. It wouldn't have been very far into the retreat, about a mile around St. Jean. And he, instead of going where he should have done with the Canadians, he went off to the right towards the canal that runs north from Ypres. At that canal, about a mile and a half out of Ypres, there's a vital bridge called Breeland Bridge. And Colonel Geddes had collected five battalions, which was all the reserves that the British Army had for the first stage of the defence. And Colonel Geddes marshalled the five battalions to form a line on the left of the Canadians, going back to the canal and back to Breeland Bridge. It was absolutely vital that Breeland Bridge be held because it was a reinforcement point for the French when they returned and for the left flank of the Canadians if they wanted to reinforce, and both did in heavy numbers the next day. But that night, 458 Brigade, 458 Battery settled beside Breeland Bridge in a brilliant position behind a little ridge from which, from the top of which they could observe, and they could see to the next ridge where the Germans had advanced ahead of the chlorine cloud, so that they were absolutely perfectly placed, out of position, out of sight of the Germans altogether, but in very, with very good sight of the front line of the German advance. To cut a long story short, they started firing, and they fired entirely on their own initiative. They decided when the Major Lambard decided when they would fire. Ammunition was obviously limited, but they reserved their fire for, and it carried on for 21 days. For 21 days, they were beside this bridge, and it's fairly clear that 458 became something of a fixture at Second Ypres. Colin mentions in his letters several times that when he met up with regular officers, they said, oh, yes, you were with 458, weren't you? 458 suffered absolutely no casualties at all as far as the officers were concerned. They had a few men who were affected, but none of the four officers were injured. And they, as I say, they were there for 21 days under heavy bombardment the whole time. Moving from the control of the various infantry brigades that were in front of them. So they were cooperating with the infantry brigades. And whenever the Germans brought up some gas or brought up some reinforcements, basically 458 just hit them on the line and aborted the attack. And the line was held in the same place that it had been for the whole of that 21 days. That wasn't true of other parts of the front at Ypres. Quite a lot of ground had to be given over to the northeast. But at this point, closest to Ypres, where Ypres was most vulnerable, the line held. I'd like to compare that battle with the next defensive battle that they fought, which was again under Colonel Lambard and was in 1917 when Colonel Lambard was commanding the 113th Army Brigade. The spring offensive of 1918, as we all know, was very successful. A huge swathe of country was taken by the Germans. And in the northernmost sector, the attack about the 9th or 10th of April was equally successful, and the Germans advanced about 10 miles. On the 11th of April, Haig issued his famous order to the army to fight to the death and told them that there was to be no more retreat. And he also called in reinforcements from Plumer's army, which was covering Ypres. So on the 12th of April, Colonel Lambard's 113th Brigade was sent south to a place called Meteren, which was just beyond Bailleul. Bailleul had fallen, and Meteren was the next small town on the main road to the Channel ports. And it had been decided that that was a point where a stand was going to be made. He was supposed to meet up with the 33rd Division, who'd been mobilised from, I think, St. Omer, and they were marching up to the same point, but the Collins Brigade arrived before the 33rd Division did. And they immediately set up, chose their own positions on the tops, and started firing at any German infantry they saw approaching. And again, I'm going to do a quote that just sets the scene. "When we came in, we landed up behind the most nondescript infantry you can imagine. Army clerks, cooks, servants, army school personnel and labour battalions with rifles hurriedly thrust upon them. They were not much use, and a Boche patrol made them run. But the Boche were taking liberties that day and paid for them. It was very pleasant shooting at the Boche before they had guns up." So what they were doing was just sitting on the top of the hill, observing any group of Germans that came towards them. They broke that group up. And the next day, just before the German guns came up, the 33rd Division came up, and the 33rd Division slotted in front of them. So they didn't have to move. The 33rd Division just came under their shelter. And there was 4 days of really quite heavy fighting. And Colin was in a farmhouse in the front line with the infantry for most of those 4 days. Colonel Lambard got quite an amusing note from the infantry brigadier who was commanding in front of Colin's observation post. The note said, "Who is the short, dark-haired man who observed from our cottage?" He hadn't even collected Colin's name. The brigadier, who Colin, in one of his letters, described as being rather jumpy, received the information, passed it on to General Pinney, who was commanding the 33rd Division, and the MC came in really remarkably quickly after that. As a sort of immediate battle honour. So that's the defensive battles, and in all the defensive battles that Colin fought, they were remarkably effective. They held the line. But it was rather different in offensive battles. I'm going to describe the first day of the Battle of the Somme, because it really illustrates what the problems were. The first day of the Battle of the Somme, he was with the 7th Division, and they were actually quite successful. Their artillery did the job that it should have done. It suppressed the German front lines, and for the most part, the 7th Division artillery infantry got through. And as a forward observation officer, Colin was up with the infantry observing. And once on the first day, in the afternoon of the first day, and once a couple of days later, pretty well the same thing happened. Colin had been ordered to, his battery, together with the other batteries of his brigade, had been ordered to fire a barrage, a creeping barrage, in front of the troops as they advanced against the enemy lines, not the front lines now, but lines further back. And immediately in front of Colin, the infantry fell behind the barrage, and he saw a group of Germans get up with a machine gun and rifles, sit on the top of a very slight ridge and mow down the infantry who were still approaching. Colin instantly took his gun off the barrage and pulled it back to target the German infantry that were causing the trouble. The colonel appeared and absolutely screamed at him for disobeying orders. This happened twice. The second time he thought he was going to be court-martialed. But both times a brigadier arrived. I think on the first occasion it was the artillery brigadier, and on the second occasion it was the infantry brigadier. But on both occasions, the brigadier arrived and congratulated Colin for what he'd done. So what's going on here? He's disobeyed orders and the colonel is screaming at him, but he's being congratulated for doing the right thing by more senior officers. We'll come on to that later, but that's something that really struck me right at the beginning. Sticking with the Somme, you asked how he developed as an officer. I think two of the most interesting passages in the book for me are his simple descriptions of how the first description just before the Battle of the Somme is the procedure by which they cut wire. It was obviously a very technical business. The guns fired, the guns of the battery fired one at a time. They couldn't fire too often because they overheated. They had to be cooled down and slightly serviced after every 40 shots. Every shot had to be observed, and every shot had to be re-aimed. By that I mean, after firing a shot, a gun, it still had quite a few seconds because the next guns were firing, but it had to lift its barrel and go back and aim exactly where it should be. The fuse had to be absolutely spot on, and the shrapnel shell had to explode within 10 yards of the wire to do any good. It took 3 days of almost continuous firing to clear the wire in front of his battery alone. And it's quite clear to me that the new divisions would not have had the technical skill, the technical know-how, the sheer experience to be able to fire with that degree of accuracy and reliably cut the wire in front of them. It's rather similar. Slightly earlier in the book, he describes selecting battery positions, and he writes down notes because he's selecting battery positions for the brigade. So he's selecting four or five battery positions. So he makes notes on each one, and again, it's very professional. He selects a spot. He checks the arc of fire. He checks the field of fire, the difference being the amount that the guns can move from side to side and the depth of field of the fire. He checks up on any buildings or trees that are in the way that might have to be, or trees particularly that might have to be moved. But he also wants cover, so he keeps any trees and things that he needs. He also has to consider supply and getting there without being observed. It's quite a technical business, and he has to check up that there's a suitable observation post within reach that has the same field of vision that the battery has got, so that it can reliably direct the guns onto the spot. Again, not usually considered, but one of the more important duties of the artillery, and it would be very surprising if the new division artillery had the skills to be able to do that with the competence that the regular divisions did. Two of the chapters in my book follow Colin's uncle, who was a man of 40, but absolutely determined to serve in the field artillery like his nephew. He was a stubborn old cuss, but he joined probably the least competent of the new divisions, the Bantam Division, and he describes the sheer incompetence of the army officers. Of the officers of the division, both infantry and artillery in that division, in the early days of the Somme. And that's there really for contrast. One can see the sheer competence of Colin's armying and the devastating incompetence of dear Uncle Duke's division.
The book discusses Colin's perspective on tactical deployment in battle and the slow adoption of necessary changes. Can you expand on the insights he offered in the book regarding these tactical adjustments and their significance in preventing unnecessary casualties during the war?
I thought long and hard about that question. I'm not sure that it's mine to answer. When I wrote the book, I was a total ignoramus. I was a retired general practitioner. I discovered these letters. I knew next to nothing about the First World War, but I realised instantly that the letters were a fantastic resource. They were a primary source of great importance. I determined to transcribe the letters. And the more I transcribed and the more I read and the more I discovered about where he'd been and when, the more important I felt it was. And I therefore wrote the book. As far as possible, in Colin's words, about a third of the book is direct quotes from him. He actually writes quite well, so I didn't have to edit his writing at all. It was a pleasure to write, but I kept it purely as a primary source, and any questions that I couldn't answer myself, I looked up the answers and put them as footnotes in the book. So I didn't really know what a battery was. So, as a footnote in the book, It tells you what a battery is. The book is written for an amateur like myself. Obviously, there's a lot in it that is useful for historians as well. But when I came to send it for publication, tried to get it published, basically it got refused by everybody. They all said that it was neither one thing nor the other. It was neither a psychological study of a damaged army officer, nor was it a proper tactical survey of the field artillery. I beg to differ. I think it's both. And I think that one impinges so much on the other that one can't discuss one without the other. But I think historians have really got to make that decision. I was very reassured when, after a few years after publication, it was written 6 years ago now, a few years after publication, it was selected by the Master Gunner at Whitehall to go on his Christmas list for reading for Royal Artillery officers in the current British Army. And I felt that was a vindication. That was something that I could take and go to the publishers and say, Yaboo. So I don't particularly want to discuss that much further. I'm just going to read out something I wrote here. I think readers and historians need to decide if my grandfather was just an overstressed maverick operating outside the conventions of his peers, or whether he was a typical, if outspoken, regular artillery officer. If the latter, the book gives much food for thought. I had doubts myself when I first published it, that the more I reread the book and the more research that I do and the more I compare it with other war diaries, the more I'm convinced that Collins' views do reflect those of his peers and that the book does offer a doctrinal narrative. We'll come on to that probably a little bit later, the doctrinal narrative, but I'm just going to pick up on your point about unnecessary casualties. I think a point that's often rather brushed under the carpet is that friendly fire casualties were inevitable in the First World War, and there were far more of them than anybody really lets on. Almost the first shell that Collins' battery fired at Mons fell short, and Colin was worried that it might have hurt somebody in the British Army, and it probably did. But the worst episode that Colin records is the second phase of the Battle of Mametz Wood at the Somme. This was the battle that involved the Welsh Division, and they'd already had a pretty torrid time in the first phase of the battle, and their divisional commander had been sent home. So almost in order to earn their spurs again, they were sent in 3 or 4 days later into the second phase of the battle. The problem with their assault was that the supporting artillery was 6,000 yards behind, which is far too far for accurate fire. They were going to advance to about nearly 7,000 yards, which was actually beyond the range of their own artillery. 4,000 Welsh were killed in vicious fighting in that wood. Nobody could see into the wood to see what was happening, so the artillery couldn't even see where their shells were dropping, and I'm sure a very large proportion, a considerable proportion of the 4,000 Welshmen who died were killed by friendly fire. One of the points that Colin makes throughout the book, it's the convention, the 1914 convention, that every shot that is fired should be observed. And that was one of the episodes where he wasn't allowed to observe it wasn't possible to observe his fire. There was an inquiry afterwards. It was fairly truncated. All the officers of the 7th Division Artillery offered to resign, and the inquiry died a complete death at that point. So it definitely happened, but that's really the worst episode that Colin describes.
Understanding the role of artillery is noted as crucial to grasping the battles of the First World War. How does the young gunner offer insight into these battles and the contributions of field artillery on the Western Front, as depicted through Colin's experiences?
I'm going to pick up on a small point that I made earlier. I mentioned that in 1917 he was sent to an army brigade. I think the importance of army brigades has been underestimated. From the 1st of January 1917, half of all artillery, field artillery brigades, were allocated to army control. That meant that the army kept a sort of register, and then any of the army brigades were then allocated to corps, and then through corps to divisions. So the army brigades were allocated to divisions, and inevitably they were allocated to those sectors which were most active. So they saw quite a lot more action probably than divisional artillery, field artillery, who revolved in and out of the line. The army brigades didn't revolve in and out of the line. They stayed where they were, and they stayed for really very long periods, for too long, I think. And not unnaturally, the divisional artillery commanders saw the army brigades as being more expendable. They didn't want to risk their own army brigades, artillery brigades particularly. They were quite happy for the army brigade to be hit, as long as they didn't lose their own artillery. That's a bit unfair, and probably only happened in one or two divisions. But they certainly received, the army brigade certainly received no TLC. There was nobody to say, "Oh, you've had too long in the line. Go back and have a rest." That simply didn't happen. And where they did feature in battle, and quite importantly in battles, they're often not really mentioned. Corps don't really mention them, and divisional reports don't really mention them, partly because they were with them for such a short time. They might have only been with a division for a week or 10 days. In the book, there's the schedule of the divisions that his army brigade was attached to, and I can't remember the number. It was something like 50 different divisions at various times that he was attached to for between 3 or 10 days, and or between 5 days and 3 weeks. It was a very peripatetic existence and an exhausting existence, because, as I say, they didn't really have their own base to go back to be looked after. But much more importantly than that, probably, and I think probably the point you're aiming at, is what was the model of command and control that Colin describes. I want to go back to the point that I was writing this as a total amateur, and I simply wrote down what he seemed to be implying to me, I was struck by the very different arrangements that were made in defence, which I've already described, in 1914 through the whole of 1914 in defence at Second Ypres, in various moments of the Somme where they might have been fighting more defensively, at Messines Ridge, and into 1918, there was one model of command. But for much of 1915 through to 1917, there was a different model of command. The first model of command, which I regard as the 1914 model, was that the batteries received brief orders to go and support the infantry in front of them, like they did at Second Ypres. They weren't told exactly what to do. They were just told to get into a good position and support the infantry in front of them. So they chose the positions for themselves. They chose the targets for themselves. They monitored their ammunition use themselves. If they were short, they didn't use so much. And they really cooperated only in single mornings of attacks where they might be called upon to coordinate a barrage with other batteries. That was one model of command. The second model of command, which was imposed on them through much of 1915 and onwards, was where they received detailed orders. They were told exactly where to go to the nearest decimal point on the map. The targets were specified similarly. Their ammunition use was predetermined, i.e. they had no control. They simply had to fire 10 shots in this barrage or 20 shots in this and another barrage. And there was absolutely no point in any liaison with the troops in front of them, because they had no input into what the targets or what support they could give to the infantry. Now, Collins' battery continued to liaise with the infantry, always liaised with the infantry, but through 1915, it was essentially pointless, except to bag the best observation posts that they could. They got them as far close up to the front line, and for that, you needed the cooperation of the infantry to help you out. But that was really the only liaison they had. And then they were asked to fire inflexible barrages. A lot of books that talk about the artillery say how fantastic these barrages were. As I've already described at the Somme, they were so rigid that they were often of more danger to their own men than they were to the enemy. And these inflexible barrages have been highly overrated as for being for the success they had. The two modes of command could be mixed. I've already described how Colin opted out and being praised by his brigadier for opting out. But that really wasn't, it was rather frowned upon to opt out of a barrage. But quite a few battles at the Somme, for instance, they fired a barrage. And then once the barrage had finished, once the first stage of the infantry advance had been done, the artillery was required to have men up front to target any counterattacks that were occurring, which might, of course, come from anywhere. So the observation officers were up the front and they were observing where was the best place to fire. So that was the two models command together. The first one was organized and the second one was free ranging. They could choose their own positions and they could choose their targets and render much more efficient support to the infantry. This was the model that Plumer used at Messines Ridge. He had brigades of artillery coming forward, most of the new army artillery, unsurprisingly, were kept to the old style of barrage, where they were told exactly what to do and when to do it. But Plumer at Messines Ridge used experienced artillery brigades in the way that I've described, the free-ranging 1914 way. There's a lovely diary entry, which I love, from Colonel Lambard at Passchendaele. And he writes in the brigade diary, where one never criticised senior command, it simply wasn't done. He wrote, why ever are we firing a preordained barrage with high explosive, smoke and gas onto points on a map in front of us when we've been given absolutely no clue of what the infantry are doing and how we are supporting them? And that an entry like that from a man like Colonel Lambard, who was a pretty straight-laced character, shows, just going back, how the discipline at Passchendaele was beginning to break down in the later stages of Gough's reign. The one can sort of one can discuss the reasons why the second mode of control might have taken over from the first. Some people, I think, the main reason was very inexperienced staff, the staff really didn't know how to run their own artillery, and certain officers were control freaks as well. Some of the regular officers were control freaks, and the sort of combination of control freakery and very inexperienced staff made it easier for for this sort of mode to take over. It was necessary, probably, for many of the very inexperienced units. Where it was being used for one unit, where the artillery officers didn't really know which end of a gun the shell came out, that mode of control was necessary and spread across to other units where it really wasn't necessary and was, in fact, counterproductive. It has been suggested that the shell shortage had something to do with it. Collins certainly never suggests that the shell shortage caused any serious problems. One has to remember that shell shortages were absolutely universal with the front line of the Royal Field Artillery. If you were up in the front line of a battle, you had a finite number of shells, and you had to conserve them. And if you only had 10 shells left, or if you had 100 shells left, you still had to be aware of how many you had left, and you had to use them judiciously. So I don't think shell shortage can be blamed as a valid reason for this change in the mode of command. Although it was certainly used as such, they used to get a weekly... In 1915, they'd get a weekly sheet saying how many shells they could use during the course of the week, and basically telling them not to use them at all until they received orders from the senior command as to what should be shot at. I think the interesting thing about this mode of command that I've been talking about is that it was a choice. Passchendaele showed that it was a choice. Gough used completely the control freakery method. Every barrage was completely controlled and came from corps, if not army, orders. But when Plumer took over, the whole thing changed. It took about 6 weeks, but the whole ethos changed. There had been no arrangements made for coordination between artillery and infantry, but within 6 weeks of Plumer taking over, all the artillery brigades had forward observation officers, SOS officers to report on attacks, and liaison officers with increasing complexity through the mudflats that were Passchendaele.
My penultimate question is, the book encompasses all aspects of field artillery at war on the Western Front and concludes with a chapter summarising the tactical developments year by year. What were some of the most significant developments or changes in tactics highlighted in the book, and how did they evolve over the course of the conflict?
I think in many ways I've already answered that question. The last bit is the bit that interests me, the idea that tactics evolved over the course of the war. I'm not convinced that they did. I think that the tactics of 1914, adjusted for trench warfare, were the right tactics. They dropped away into people not knowing what to do. And by 1918, they were fighting by the same tactics that they'd fought in 1914, of course adapted in the light of gas and the light of tanks and the light of aeroplanes. There was all sorts of technical developments that affected, but the basic tactical ideas, the basic way that the army worked, the basic command structures remained as they had got back to what they'd been in 1914. I'm never quite sure. I was never quite sure when I wrote it whether the last chapter was the weakest or the strongest part of the book. It was written, as I say, as a complete amateur, and I interpreted what Colin was saying and tried to tabulate it, and then explain the tables that I'd prepared. I knew nothing about the learning curve, for instance, or SS documentation or command controversies. I hadn't read any biographies of First World War generals, certainly hadn't read any academic articles. And I deliberately didn't, because I didn't want to colour what I was trying to say. But since then, I've done a lot of research. I've researched the Mons in great detail, and I've researched field service regulations, which is the doctrine that the army took to war with them in 1914. And I come to the realization that everything I say in the last chapter, I agree with. Simply put, it doesn't mention field service regulations, doesn't mention learning curves or anything like that, but it's basically what I believe happened in the war. And nothing I've read or learnt since has changed my mind on that. Colin in 1914, as far as I was concerned, was following the doctrine he'd been taught at Woolwich in 1912-13, and that doctrine was field service regulations. I'm going to get on my hobby horse now. Field service regulations as a doctrinal concept for the British Army of 1914 is a subject that has been disgracefully neglected in the academic literature. It took me quite a few years to find out anything useful about it at all. I am delighted that the young gunner introduced me to the subject and gave me a springboard for researching it more fully.
And on that very convenient segue, where can people learn more about the young gunner and Colin's service?
About Colin's service, there's really very little to add. At the end of the war, he'd had a spectacular finale, commanding an artillery brigade at the Battle of Courtrai, and was awarded the DSO for that, so that he had two DSOs and MCs by the end of the war. And he was called a major, but he was actually doing a colonel's job, running an artillery brigade. But at the end of the war, within a week, he'd been demoted back to captain. Of course, he was only 25. And he didn't know what to do. His whole war had shrunk during 1918 to his own battery. He wasn't interested in joining the staff. He was out of touch with everybody in England but his mother. When he went home, he didn't really know where he was, I don't think. His reality was the front line. In many ways, he's a very sad character in 1918. He wanted the army to go on. He wanted the war to go on because he really didn't know any other way of living. And so he was completely lost when the war finished. He took a few months to think about it. Quite a lot of officers left the army, but he didn't. He didn't have the energy to make even that decision, I don't think. And he was sent out to India in 1919 and stayed there for many years. He transferred to the Royal Horse Artillery, but he was never promoted. In 1929, he was still a captain, despite his stellar war record. And he was promoted major on retirement in 1929. And in fact, another story, but he re-enlisted in 1939 and was commanding artillery almost from the start of the war, anti-aircraft artillery. As far as finding out from his contemporaries, there are a couple of artillery war diaries that I think are valuable. There's one written by a chap called Schreiber. General Schreiber was a successful general in the Second War, and he wrote a diary on 1914. And there's another one by a Lieutenant MacLeod, quite a long one that's fairly well known. And there are a lot of similarities between both their diaries and Colin's diary for 1914. And that was one of the things that reassured me that Colin wasn't a maverick, that actually these two diaries are remarkably similar. But no general books that I know of, and I've read a lot of them now, follow the sort of narrative that I've given in this book, the narrative that is guided by field service regulations. And no books that deal with senior generals do either, concentrating on corps and army correspondence, one doesn't really get a feel of the front line. There are two semi-classic books on the artillery, and basically I recommend neither of them. I think there's quite a lot of nonsense in both of them. So it is quite difficult to do that sort of research. The only work that traces the role of the artillery through the Great War with reference to command and tactics was written in 1918, and to my mind it should be far better known. I haven't seen it quoted in any of the books that I've gone through trying to find more information about the artillery. It's privately published, not easy to find, and it was written by a Major Stuart Rawlins, and it is the history of the development of the British Army and artillery in France from 1914 to 1918. He had access to all the artillery papers at GHQ after the armistice, and he was obviously bored out of his mind, and he wrote this book during the course of 1918. And it's, to my mind, pretty well the last word on the subject. It deals with doctrine, it deals with tactics, and it deals with command structures in considerable detail. I certainly wouldn't argue with any of it, and I don't think Colin would either.
So on that note, I'm going to say, David, thank you very much for your time.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS2195. Until next time.